We welcome everyone who's here. While guys are handing out, there'll be two pages tonight. I'm not sure we'll get through both pages, but I think we will. So go ahead and hand them both out. We're talking, obviously, about the book of Job, and I said we were not going to do a verse-by-verse study. We're going to do an overview, as the panel above me says. And it may seem, since we're going to spend two lessons and not even get out of the first 10 verses, so to speak, it may seem like we're going to really get bogged down if we try to do 42 chapters. But I assure you, part of it is going to go much quicker than that. We're really trying to do the setting. Let me say, I welcome everyone that's here, and we have visitors. In fact, we have an esteemed visitor with us. And it's good to see Brother Hall. We don't get to see as much of him as we'd like to see him. Unfortunate circumstances brought him north, but we're glad you're here. Glad to have you with us. If you'll turn to Job chapter 1, I'll go back and forth from Job 1 all during the lesson, although I am going to look at a number of other passages and interrelate them with this book. I'm not going to spend much by the way of review of last week's lesson, but if you remember, we're trying to set the background to the book. And last week we dealt with the dating of the book, which is a problem in itself. And I took the position, and really will hold with that, that the book is either an ancient book or in reference to an ancient event. I do believe that Job lived considerably before Abraham, and that there's a good bit of indication within the book to that, all of those reasons that I gave you last week, as well, really, as the geographical display that we're going to look at tonight as we try to answer the question and go back to looking at the question we ended with last week. And I said we'd take it up tonight, so let's get into it. We asked the question, where does the story take place? And I'll say that, do the kind of review in a minute. There's, as with dating the book, there's equal disagreement over, you know, where the book takes place, over the geographic location of Uz from chapter 1, or Uz, as it's sometimes referred to, but I'll call it Uz. But there's just as much disagreement over the where as the when. A lot of cultures, probably because of the status of the book, the nature of the story, a lot of cultures have laid claim to Job, and that also serves to kind of discolor maybe where it is. There is a Palestinian folk tradition that puts Job being from the village of Al-Jura, that would be outside, ancient Magdala, that is Mary Magdalene in the Bible. She would have come from there. Which would be just off the coast of the Sea of Galilee, or the Lake of Tiberias. There is a Turkish tradition that puts him further north, obviously, in Turkey, where in what is now Edessa. There is, in southern Oman, there is a tradition where they even have a tomb. They have a tomb of Job in Jabal Qara, outside the city of Salalah, in southern Oman. And up in the districts of Lebanon, the mountain districts of Lebanon, there is the Druze community. And you're seeing, I think, some of this on your outline. I think I put that on your version of it. But they also have a tomb of Job in the mountain district of El Kuf, up in the Druze community of Lebanon. And you could go on with that. Those are some of the more well-known and more popular. So you see all over the Middle East, really, people laying claim to Job. Job is from here. Job is one of our ancestors, etc. Now, if we tried to take a little bit more conservative approach by strictly what the Bible says, which is what I want to do looking at Job chapter 1, I think that if we look at the references in the book of Job as well as other places, we'll begin to see, and let me put one of those, where did Job live? Yeah, I'll come back to that one. I don't want to actually address that one now. But let me address Lamentations 4. Sometimes Job is strictly identified with the kingdom of Edom. Job is an Edomite. We address some of that with the names that are in the book. I talked about that. I said that a lot of people want to view the book as being a much later book because you would have all these descendants of Abraham that would be named after the characters in the book, such as, oh, different ones, Tima and Buzz and so forth and on, you know, so on as we looked at. But I said there was another way to look at that, and that is that these people are being named after ancestors of both these individuals in the book of Job as well as those of Abraham. And I think there's reason to believe that. But if you look at Uz, a lot of times it's associated with the kingdom of Edom. However, go with me to the book of Lamentations and look at Lamentations chapter 4 and verse 21 and notice an interesting phrase there and notice the phraseology. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom. And notice how it puts it. O daughter of Edom that dwellest or dwells in the land of Uz. Now, if Uz was in Edom, if Uz was a part of Edom, then it would be the other way around. In other words, it would be, O daughter maybe of Uz that dwells in the land of Edom. But in fact, what you see is Edom is a part of the greater region of Uz. There are other locations that indicate perhaps where it is. And I put these on here and decided to deal with them differently. But if you go again back to that table of nations in Genesis 10, and we did this last week for an indication as well. But if you look at verse 23, you see of the descendants of Shem, and I'm going to show a map here in a minute and I'll indicate that. But if you were to look at the old area of Aram, Aram is a descendant of Shem, and then Uz is in fact in Genesis 10 a descendant of Aram. And if you follow that migration, basically what you're doing is starting out in the Tigris-Euphrates area, Mesopotamia, Aramea, or Aram, and you're going west and southwest. In other words, you would be starting in modern-day Iraq, going back towards Syria, and perhaps down into Saudi Arabia. And I'll show that on a map in just a moment. And if that's true, then you're getting again down into an area that is broader, and that's what I'm trying to indicate. It's an area broader than Edom, and which makes perfect sense, coincides with Lamentations 4, that makes Edom a part of Uz. Now, all of that, to put that in very simple terms, is to say Uz is not part of Edom. Edom is part of Uz, and Uz is perhaps a much greater region. Now, if you continue to look at your outline, or if we're looking in the Bible, you'll also notice that, let me go back and say something interestingly enough, and you might find this interesting. There are some ancient texts that indicate all that I said is true. One of them is from the Dead Sea Scrolls, in particular the War Scroll, and makes reference to the land of Uz, and it refers to Uz as existing somewhere. Notice the indication in this particular scroll that Uz existed beyond the Euphrates. It makes the river Euphrates a reference point. And again, if you're looking at a map, and I will show that in a moment, Euphrates is the reference point in the scroll, not, interestingly enough, the Jordan River, which would, if it were strictly Edom, you would tend to think that the river Jordan would be the reference point, but it's not. It's the Euphrates River. And you'll find that, for those of you that might be interested, it's in the War Scroll. It's in column 2, verse 11. But if we go on further with that, look at another passage, and you see it on your outline, but I'll put it up here for you. Look at Jeremiah chapter 25 and read together verses 20 and 21. Very much like what Jeremiah says in Lamentations. In other words, he speaks of the land of Uz. Not a city, a village, or a community, but a whole region or a whole area. He speaks of, and I quote, all the kings, plural, of the land of Uz. And then you'll notice as he begins to list those in verse 21, he includes Edom. So again, that indicates that Uz is a much broader region. Now, why is this important? Well, because people dating Job to a late book and dating these people that are involved as descendants of Abraham and Esau and so forth want to confine it to the land of Edom. But I think what you can see in all of this is that it's a much broader region. So again, what I would say about that is all of these things point to a vicinity that includes Edom, but is much broader in scope. Now let me show you on a map what I'm talking about. This is a modern map, just for our reference. So you can see where Iraq, if you'll focus on the Persian Gulf, and we're very familiar with this territory of Iraq and Saudi Arabia and so forth. The old area, if you're looking on the map, the orange-colored Jordan. Jordan and that little tip there right below it of Saudi Arabia, they basically comprise the old Edom. And what I'm basically saying is that Uz is a much broader region, or the Bible seems to indicate it's a much broader region, that basically you had this migration that's indicated from Genesis 10 that starts, if you'll notice where Baghdad is on this map, that basically starts a little southwest of Baghdad, goes west and southwest into Syria and Saudi Arabia. That's what I was indicating a moment ago. If we were to kind of put it on here, Edom would basically be in that region. Very southern Jordan, very western Saudi Arabia. And that's not an exact, but it's pretty close to the confines of Edom. But really what seems to be indicated is that Uz is maybe a much broader territory. Maybe extending, again, notice how I'm pushing it up toward Aramea and on up Jordan, and it perhaps goes even more north and more east from there, as I'll indicate in just a moment. But from these passages, at least that. Now, we continue to talk about the general location. You notice also in the book that you deal with this when this attack comes, or these attacks, plural, come. In other words, when Satan challenges God and is allowed to take all these things away from Job. If you're looking in the latter verses of Job 1, go down to verse 15 beginning, you see the Sabaeans fell upon him, and then later the Chaldeans in verse 17 fell upon him, and so forth. Now, if you began to look at these indications, again, we've already seen Genesis 10, but I want to hold with that idea, that thought in mind, because this is really what I believe that that Uz descended from. But if you look at the Sabaeans, one of the problems, and when I first did a study of Job years ago, one of the problems that you run into, going back to that map, is that there are several different cities, areas, even major cities, that are called either Seba, Saba, Sheba, Shaba, something like that. And some of those can be eliminated very quickly, but you basically come down to three of them. And it will have you, there will be a Sheba in basically northern Saudi Arabia, extreme eastern Saudi Arabia, and even in Africa. And it becomes which one of these is the most likely Sheba or Saba from which you're getting these Sabaeans that attack in Job. And depending on if you take an earlier or later date, you're going to go with one or the other. Now, I'm convinced that for a number of reasons, and I'm not going to get that deep into it tonight, but I'm convinced for a number of reasons that the Sabaeans that he's talking about are likely those of the old Aksumite kingdom, and the Aksumite kingdom was on either side of the Red Sea, extreme southern Arabia or Saudi Arabia, and then across the Red Sea into Africa. It entailed a little bit of the Sudan, basically Eritrea, and the very northern part of Ethiopia, and that area in Africa. Now, if you add that to the fact, if you're looking at Job 1, that the Chaldeans attacked, basically what you have is an attack coming from the Sabaeans, attack coming from the Chaldeans. Okay, what does all of that mean practically? Well, let's look at a map again. Again, we've got Edom, and again, we've got our proposed Uz. If we put those two places that are being indicated, likely indicated by these attacks, that would be the Aksumite kingdom, or the Sabaeans that would be coming from that area and known to attack the various tribes of Arabia. And then the Chaldeans would be up in that area generally. Now again, that would fit. It might be a long stretch for any of these Sabaeans to be going on a raid if they were coming from, notice the bottom where Oman and Yemen, well, that's an area of a Sheba, but that's a long way to go for a raid. And the other Sheba comes much later. I don't believe it fits, so likely. But this Saba with these Sabaeans fits very well. You could easily make this raid. Basically, you're raiding just a little bit here, north and east from the Sabaeans, and basically you're raiding just to the south of the Chaldeans, and that fits. So again, the indication in the book would tell you that Uz is a broader region, but likely it extends to basically middle Saudi Arabia, or at least that part of Saudi Arabia. Now let's go just a little bit further, and I'm going to be done with this. Some of you are probably wondering, man, how deep into this are you going to get? Well, not much deeper. But let's go a little bit further with it. If we put together the fact, going back to those companions of Job, remember we had the Temanites, Eliphaz, we had the Shuhites, we had the Naamathites, and we had the Buzites. Now you can easily plot where all of these people, where they were. And I'm going to show this on a map, and again, trying to indicate where Uz would have been. The Temanites, or Edomites, were associated with the Arabians, the Dedanites, and the Buzites. Various passages will show you that, some of those that we cited, and some of those you see on your outline. The Shuhites were in northern Arabia toward Mesopotamia. That fits. The Naamathites bordered on southern Edom. That certainly fits. And the Buzites were in the extremities of northern Arabia and even extending into Syria. And that certainly fits. Let's look at a map and I'll show you why I'm saying all of this. If we were to plot all of this, we've got our Edom. I hope that shows up. I'm not sure how well that's going to show up. But anyway, we've got our Edom. We've got the Chaldeans up there. We've got the Sabaeans down there. That's just what we were looking at a moment ago. Now let's add these territories of these companions of Job. We've got the Temanites, and they're bordering right on northern Saudi Arabia, right in that area. And really just to the east of them and a little bit southward would be Shua, or the Shuhites. If we were to add the Naamathites, they're right in southern Edom. And then the Buzites, and just to squeeze it in there, really, you'd want to drop that word down a little bit, but just to try to keep this orderly. So just to the south, about the Jordan area there, perhaps going northward into as far as, if you can see on the map, Damascus. And there's some indication that ancestors of the Buzites and descendants of Aram, again, that migration westward, would have established that very ancient city of Damascus. Now, saying all of that, what does it mean? Well, pretty good indication that Uz is a much broader territory and that Job is part of this. Now, exactly where does he live? No way to know. He can be in the Edom parts. He can be up there where Jordan is. He can be in Syria, literally. He can be extreme eastern part of this region, well down into Saudi Arabia. He can be north, even close into the area of Iraq, etc. There's no way to know. There's only one other indication here, and if you're looking at Job 1, notice what the Bible describes of him, and I put that on your outline, that he was the greatest of all the men noticed of the east. And so at least it's giving you that indication. So that's why I'm saying that all of these passages together, to entail all of this, all of these areas, would be a much broader region than just that little the little Edomite kingdom. And that's where so often this is pigeonholed. So I just want to get an idea, give an idea of possibly where Uz was. All right, now, we'll go further on the outline. Let's actually get into Job chapter 1. In other words, what am I saying? Bottom line, let's summarize. I believe Job is a very ancient book, older than at least the time of Job. I don't know when the book was written, but the time of Job predates Abraham, or roughly 2000 BC, and may go back, 1,000 years, 1,500 years, could easily be back in that time. The setting of the book, most likely Saudi Arabia, as we know it today, can be anywhere from Jordan into Syria, Iraq, or mid-Saudi Arabia. It can be anywhere in that area. You saw that circle and tailing. But for our purposes, as we look at the book, probably far more important than all of that is for us to actually look at what the book says and the application to us. And so if you're looking at your outline, drop down to the presentation before God. And if you look at Job chapter 1, as was read for us a moment ago, we saw last week and we looked at this fact that Job was, you know, the father, the patriarch, the priest, acting priest for the family, the community, perhaps for a large, broad area. But he's a very conscientious father, concerned for his children. They're doing this feasting. He's offering these sacrifices, lest they would have sinned while they were doing it. But in the midst of all of this, you see that Job is obviously a really good man, going along, being faithful. We see him described as such. We see his daily activity exemplifying the fact that he is a really good man. We see just how exemplary he is because the Bible describes him as the greatest in verse 3 of all the men of the East. But it also describes him as a man that is the best of the best, as we get into verse 6 that Paul read for us a little bit ago. And as this day comes, there's a whole lot of disagreement naturally over what this is talking about exactly. But as this day of presentation comes, God will eventually, no one argues this, God will eventually come to the point, regardless of what's going on, God will come to the point of saying, "Have you, Satan, considered my servant Job? He is the best of the best." Now, as you look at this passage, there are a number of things that immediately come out. As you're reading this, there was a day, verse 6, when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Some natural questions arise. Who were the sons of God? Were they angels? A lot of people think so. And generally, they look at the book and let the book be its own commentary, which I would generally do. I would say that's the best thing. Look for another reference of the phrase in the book. And get an indication of what the author himself means by a phrase, sons of God. There is another possibility, and we're going to look at Job 38 in just a moment, but there's another possibility, and that is that it's referring to people. So we ask the question, what is meant by sons of God? And what is meant by this, they came to present themselves before the Lord. We'll also ask the question, is the challenge, if you're looking at your outline, number 4, is the challenge between Satan and God something that happened only in antiquity? Or does that kind of challenge go on today? We don't see it, obviously. But is Satan up there or out there or whatever somewhere? And there's a challenge over you or me. And is he challenging God? If God decides to bless you, or in the end, if God decides to save you, is Satan going to challenge that? And is Satan going to say about you or me, would he say something this similar to this? Well, did he do it for nothing? I mean, look what you gave him in his life or her life. I mean, does that kind of thing go on, or is it strictly something that happened in that day and time? We might also ask the question as we look at chapter 1, a lot of Christians who have suffered have asked this question. Can Satan afflict people today? If he could back then, if he could request and receive permission from God to afflict people by taking away things from them, even his own children. And then eventually, if he could afflict them physically with all of these boils and so forth, can Satan do that kind of thing today? So a lot of questions that grow out of this book. No doubt about that. Let's start with this question of who were the sons of God? Because if it's angels, it has nothing to do with us. If it's people, it perhaps does. The phrase that's used in Job 38 and verse 7, the same phrase, and I'd like for you to turn over there and we'll briefly look at it. Without question refers to angels, at least in my mind. Some people do question it, but not many. Most would say this is talking about angels, and I'd be one of them. God is questioning Job here. And as God questions Job, he says to him, "Where were you," basically, as he humbles Job. He says, "Where were you," verse 7, "when the morning stars sang together," and then notice, "and all the sons of God shouted for joy." Now, if you strictly look at verse 7, it wouldn't tell you much, but if you look at the paragraph or the stanza, it's poetry here, but if you look at the stanza in verse 4 beginning, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" Now, that immediately eliminates human beings. There are no humans when God lays the foundation of the earth. So where were you, Job? Well, obviously you weren't born, nor were any of your ancestors, because man wasn't created when God laid the foundations of the earth, but the angels were. Obviously they were there, witnessed the creation, and God is really saying that. He says, and he asks these hard questions of Job, you know, who laid the measures of, if you know, who has stretched the line upon it, the plumb line is the idea, you know, construction there, building there, we're talking about. Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Who laid the cornerstone of the world and the universe? Obviously, those are questions we can't answer. Job couldn't answer, nor can we. Verse 7. Were you there when the morning stars sang together? And were you there when the sons of God, angels, shouted for joy at the creation of the earth? Now that's an amazing thing in itself. It's an awesome thing to think about. But that's not really the point tonight that we're looking at. Because if Job 1 means that there was a day when all the angels came before God and presented themselves, and some are faithful, obviously, and Satan and others are not, it really doesn't apply much to us, because that's not something we take part in. That would be the angels. But there's some natural questions that you have to begin to answer. Now, these angels, are they men? Well, let's ask the question, could they be people? Obviously, in chapter 38, I'm not denying that they're definitely angels there. But can sons of God refer to people? Well, yes. If you go back to Genesis chapter 6, and I'd like for you to do that with me. Equally, like Job 38 is using sons of God to speak of angels, Genesis 6 speaks of people. Now, there's debate about this, because sometimes when people see sons of God, especially in the Old Testament, every time they want to say it's angels. There's no problem with making it angels in Job 38. I agree it is. There's much problem with making it angels in Genesis 6. Because what you've got to have here, if they're angels, you're going to have angels beginning to lust after human women, and they're going to begin to intermarry with them, or take them and mate with them and produce hybrid offspring. Some say, well, that's exactly what you have. They cohabited with them, and they produce these giants in the earth. But this doesn't really fit, because the context in Genesis 6, and please hear this, the context in Genesis 6 goes on not to describe what God does with angels or what God does with even hybrid individuals. The context in chapter 6 is that God looks down after this mingling, this mixture of sons of God and daughters of men. God looks down upon, verse 5, man. So what you have in this context is God looking at a group of people who are referred to as sons of God and a group of people who are referred to as daughters of men. And once they come together and children are born of that mixture, you have man, but you have all unfaithful men. And God then judges man. He finds an exception in Noah. But the rest of people, or the rest of humanity, deserve to be judged, and he judges them. Now, I want to suggest to you that that's the same thing you have in Job 1. If you look at Genesis 6 and you go to Job 1, you really see the same kind of picture. Not exact, no doubt about that. But you see a very similar picture. You see people come before God to be judged, just as they are being judged by God in Genesis 1. But that wouldn't hold up unless you can prove that sons of God at least can be a reference to people. And you easily can. Person might say, Genesis 6, I can see that going either way. Well, maybe so. But other passages you can't. When you come to the New Testament, God uses the phrase sons of God without question to refer to people. And generally speaking, it refers to faithful people, righteous people, or in the case of the New Testament, to Christians. In Romans chapter 8 and verses 14 and again in verse 19, Paul without question uses sons of God. Now, those of you that might use the King James, let me caution you. Sons of God appears a lot in the New Testament, but many times the word in the original is actually children. It just simply says children of God. For example, John chapter 1 says sons of God in the King James. But many of your translations will say children of God, and that's correct. Because the word is for children, but not in Romans 8. The word is very definitely sons. Or in that passage in Hebrews 12, when God is speaking of chastisement there, He talks about dealing with Christians as with sons. You'll notice sons as opposed to illegitimate children. And the word is not children, it's sons. And there are other passages as well. So the point being, like Galatians chapter 4, Paul does the same thing in verse 6 there. Christians are referred to as sons of God. Now what am I saying in all of that? Well, I'm saying that the reference in Genesis 6, most logically, sons of God refers to people. Very definitely, when you come to the New Testament, it becomes a phrase that's used several times for people. And does it make sense, then, to go back and look at these in Job chapter 1 and say, these are people that are being judged? Well, another reason I would say it's people as opposed to angels is the fact that it's a judgment scene. You're post-creation of man here. It's after the creation of men. And it's a judgment scene. And if you read this, if you look at Job chapter 1 and verse 6, they're coming to present themselves before the Lord. Satan is coming, and God questions Satan, and Satan says, I've been walking around on the earth, or roaming around, as Paul read. And the Lord then says, have you considered my servant Job? This is a judgment scene. This is where God is looking at the actions of these beings, be they angels or people. And really, no one doubts that. So my question would be this. If it's angels, can it be? Does God judge angels now? And the answer is no. He did at one point in time before the foundation of the earth, but He doesn't any longer. In other words, let's say it like this, try to make it as simple as possible. Without question, if you put everything the Bible says, and we're not going to do that tonight, but if you put everything the Bible says about angels together, you have to come away, without question, that angels were created before the earth was created, and obviously before man was. And if you look at that, you have to also say there was a time when angels had a choice. They had a freedom of will. They could be faithful to God or unfaithful to God. The Bible describes a certain amount of angels, maybe 2/3 from Revelation 12, I don't know, but a certain group of angels who remain faithful to God. They will forever be faithful to God. They will forever be His ministering spirits, His servants, etc. They will worship God and glorify God, and they will do God's bidding in all the different ways they've done God's bidding. There's another group of angels, quite probably led by Satan as the ruler, perhaps a third of them from Revelation 12, the stars of heaven, etc., perhaps. But there's nonetheless a group of angels. They're often referred to as demons, sometimes simply as spirits, but together with Satan, the, I think, undeniable leader of this group. The archangel, so to speak, or archenemy, so to speak. They were unfaithful. They rebelled against God, and they were judged. And the Bible speaks of, if you're looking on your outline, you can see where it talks about, where I put some references down there. The Bible speaks of the judgment to these angels. I'll wait for that point. If you look at certain passages in the Bible, such as 2 Peter chapter 2, or Jude 6. Even the reference in Matthew 8 where the demon spoke to Jesus and said, have you come to torment us before the time, etc. They were judged by God. And they recognized that judgment. They are reserved against a time of judgment. There's no possibility of repentance. There's no possibility of salvation, etc. They are judged by God. They stand in judgment by God. Now, if you look at Job chapter 1, this is not the scene in Job 1. This isn't God considering the angels to see their faithfulness or not. This is God looking at human beings. The last point I'd offer in reference to that would be this. God doesn't suggest a Gabriel here. In other words, Satan is walking around, and if he's walking around looking at all the sons of God, and says, I've been walking around in the earth and looking at all of these sons of God, etc. God doesn't say, well, have you considered my servant Gabriel? Or have you considered my servant Michael? He could have. And we know they're very faithful angels. And we know that they do what God says to do, but he doesn't do that. He says, have you considered my servant Job, a human? So I think the picture that you see in Job 1, obviously, is the sons of God are human beings, and they're standing before God in judgment. Now that leads us to a number of things here. Because the question is the picture we see here then in Job 1, is this something that only went on, let's say, in ancient times, before Abraham, and after Abraham came, all of that changed? Or after Moses came, perhaps, some would say, all of that changed. Or certainly after Jesus came, all of that changed. Is that something that only goes on then, or is that something that goes on now? If you're looking at your outline, I want you to go down to the point that after God, of course, suggests, you know, have you considered my servant Job? Go down with me to the very last point on your outline. This should be on page, I hope it's on page 6 of your outline. But go down to letter C, and let's look at this idea and ask this last question. We'll ask it quickly. Does Satan do the same thing? I'm inclined to believe Satan does the same thing, maybe not as we see it here exactly, but in essence, the same exact thing. Let's consider who Satan is and what he does. First of all, he's the adversary. Interestingly enough, some would say this is the most ancient reference to Satan. And interestingly enough, as you notice, as it says in verse 6, and Satan came also among them. If you look at the original language, it literally says, and the Satan came among them. The word Satan in Hebrew means adversary. And what it is saying is, man's chief adversary came among them. Now here's the scene, as I see it in Job 1. Everybody stands before God. Maybe there was this special day. If there is, we don't know any more about it than Job 1, so it doesn't do a whole lot to speculate. It doesn't do any good to speculate about it. Maybe there was a day set aside every year or whatever. That doesn't matter. That's not important. They are standing before God in judgment. And God, they're presenting themselves to God for consideration or whatever. They stand before Him is what it literally says. The idea in the original is. God judges them. And Satan patrols. I mean, that's really the picture you see. I mean, he's roaming around and he's patrolling and so forth. And he's objecting to God's approval of anybody. And God just kind of cuts right to the chase and says, have you considered my servant Job? In other words, as God, read it together with me again. Paul read it. Let's look at it again. The Lord said, verse 8, have you considered my servant Job? And he reiterates what you see in verse 1. A perfect man, an upright man. He fears God. He eschews evil, etc. And then Satan, the adversary, the one that stands in opposition, no matter how good you are. I mean, Job, this description given of Job in chapter 1 is about as good as it gets. If this is said about you, you're all right. But Satan doesn't even consider that. He just immediately, well, he doesn't do it for anything, does he? And you just see him in a snide remark to God. He's the adversary. He stands against us. The Hebrew term means that. But much later in time, go down with me, if you will, to Zechariah chapter 3. Now we've come all the way down in history, and we're down to the time of the rebuilding of the temple, and this would be, you know, roughly 520 to 535, that era. And we come down in the 6th century B.C., and look at Zechariah chapter 3, and it says, he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. And the Lord said to Satan, the Lord rebuke thee, O Satan, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Now Joshua, it says, was clothed with filthy garments, stood before the angel, and he answered and spoke unto those that stood before him, saying, take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with a change of raiment. You see, in figurative language, what's going on here? He's a human being, but he's a good human being. And he sins, yes, but God removes sin. And so as a human being, he stands judged by God,
And God is finding him righteous because he's forgiving him. Now, in figurative language, that's what it's saying. And obviously, it brings in, if you look at verse 8, it brings in, of course, the whole idea of Jesus, the branch, and so forth, that makes forgiveness possible. But my point tonight is, look at it. Job 1 is showing Satan saying, they don't deserve, you know, to be approved by you. They don't deserve to be cleared by you. They all stand before you presenting themselves, and they're guilty. Well, have you considered my servant Job? He's perfect, and he's upright, and he takes, you know, he turns away from evil, which is what eschews evil means. And Satan said, well, he doesn't do it for nothing. Satan is the adversary, and he stands accusing. It's what the very name the devil means, the accuser, the slanderer. It's like 1 Peter chapter 5 and verses 8 through 10. Look at that passage. It's almost verbatim what's going on in Job. The devil, a roaring lion, stalks about seeking whom he may devour. Doesn't that sound exactly like Job 1? I've been walking to and fro in the earth. And the Bible goes on to say, your adversary, the devil, the one that stands against you, the one that accuses you, the slanderer. In fact, look at Revelation chapter 12 with me as we'll close this out tonight. In Revelation chapter 12, as it pictures Satan here and describes that war in heaven and so possibly the rebellion and the judgment against angels in antiquity. But notice verses 10 through 12. And as it describes in verse 10, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of His Christ for the accuser of our brethren. We see it in Job 1. We see it in Zechariah 3. Now we see it in the New Testament. And nothing's changed. Satan is exactly the same. He's the same perhaps before Abraham. He's the same at the rebuilding of the temple. He's the same now. He's the accuser of the best of the best. He's the accuser of the sons of God. He's the slanderer. Have you considered my servant Job? God's fair estimation of Job was that he was perfect. He was genuine. He was whole. He was upright. He was moral. He had his dignity about him. He eschewed evil. He turned away from evil. He was my servant. He serves me. That's God's estimation of Job. It would have been God's estimation of Joshua in Zechariah 3. It would be God's estimation of you if you're a faithful Christian. And Satan would be standing there the whole time accusing and slandering. Yeah, well, maybe he does, but he doesn't do it for nothing. You know, he's guilty, guilty, guilty. And the only reason he ever obeys you is you buy him off. And that's the whole point. As we get into this in the book of Job, God is going to prove that is not why righteous people obey God. They obey God for their integrity. They obey God because it's right. They obey God because they humble themselves before God. And even if they do not understand the circumstances of life, they will still obey God. And that's the challenge that God issues back to Satan and says, yes, he will. And God will be proven. And we're going to see all of that as we go through the chapters of Job. It's an amazing book, obviously. But we're going to deal with Satan. We won't see Satan mentioned. We won't see him discussed. We won't see all of it. But he's there. He did it. And in the background, he waits, watches to see Job break. Job bends. We'll see that. But he never breaks. He's faithful to God.